Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2.
Good heavens, isolated instances of this phenomenon have occurred throughout history. People do sort of blow up, spontaneously combust, you know.
My God.
Now look here, the only people who are that inactive are pensioners, the sick, or the unemployed.
I mean, you know, I only invent the bomb. I don't drop it.
We think it might affect sales if people begin to suspect.
Well, don't tell them then.
Unfortunately, one of our reporters may have got quite near the truth. We have to be very careful.
Well, fire him. We could always kill him.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Thirty years after Pan Am Flight 103 crash in Lockerbie, which was pinned on the Libyans, more evidence, critical evidence, was fabricated after the crash by the CIA. So you really blew it up then, eh? That Palestinian ambassador to the UK, Hussam Zomlot, he visited Bristol this week and he takes us through the plight of his people, confined to enormous concentration camps put there by the Zionist Israeli government. The Palestinians surviving in the face of overwhelming financial and military odds. And Putin, President of Russia, speaks to the Russian people, applauding Trump's pullout of Afghanistan and Syria. But will Trump be allowed to do it this time? And Brexit, at the end of the hour, Brexit as you've never heard it before, stand-up comedy. Brilliant bit of biting satire, but I guarantee you won't be hearing this on the BBC. And perhaps it's because the BBC wouldn't allow this sort of lampooning of the establishment. Britain's political discourse and journalism is in the state that it is. The desperate state. 10 minutes of euphoria at the end of the show, the last show of 2018. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. This week, the Bristol Healing Rooms. Spiritual healing. Does it work or not? Well, we give it a go. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. So, Martin, the news has just come through that Gatwick Airport is open again, amazingly. The drone, though, the so-called drone, reports of drones as what's closed Gatwick, but have you seen any pictures of them?
Nope.
One I saw on the Daily Mail, one of the Daily World pages, it was very, very distant, a little speck, and it actually seemed to flap. Now, I thought birds flap, not drones. But anyway, the point here really being, it's just a very quick way of dealing with the story, is that around all airports, there are lots and lots of people, many of them retired, who are plane spotters, and they have very, very good cameras. So I'm very surprised that nobody has managed to get a photograph of this drone, or these drones, in the press.
Well, there was a drone swarm which attacked the Russian airbase in Syria about 6 months ago, and they managed to shoot down virtually all of them and capture some of them. And they also gave a press conference where they said they were all being directed by a US AWACS plane, and they gave a photograph of the plane. And they were saying that this was said to be carried out by militants, but these drones were in fact high-tech drones, and they were being orchestrated by the Americans to attack our airbase. Nobody really noticed, but the Russians basically pointed the things that the Americans were doing that. But they had the skills to knock them all down. I'm surprised that the British military aren't able to do that in Gatwick. Why not?
Well, a police officer emailed me, at least he was a police officer when I knew him, and he said, well, this could be some sort of exercise for the run-up to Brexit, if there's some sort of chaos with people not being, or airports grinding to a halt.
Yeah, well, don't forget that the British High Command, including Carlton Smith, who's the new head of the British Army, have been banging on about how the Russians are going to hack our infrastructure, they're going to cut the internet cables in the sea, and we've got to... In other words, this might be a staged event to try and, you know, get support for, you know, the cyber warriors in the British military. I don't know, I'm not saying that is the case, it's just a possibility.
Or, I mean, it's very strange that the pictures of the drones have not been published anywhere. I mean, I do find that very peculiar, because that would help people identify it, might help actually do something about it, saying, I know someone who's got one of these drones, that kind of thing, and actually to get it stopped. So that doesn't make any sense whatsoever to me, but it could possibly be the idea of sort of floating the idea that you know, at any time now, our airports could grind to a halt.
Well, it's quite likely there's going to be some kind of false flag cyber attack in Britain, which will be blamed on the Russians. They've been flagging it up for months. So this could be this, but I don't know. I haven't got any inside information. I've no idea what happened here.
Also, on to Lockerbie then, 30 years on. The official story is that the Libyans planted a bomb on there. We're still not entirely sure why, what the motivation was for that. But that seems to have been the decision made. We had the US intelligence officer, I'm not sure, she was working for the CIA in Iraq and Libya. And she had a completely different story, Martin, didn't she? We had her
Susan
on the
Linda.
Show recently. A couple of years ago. But we have clips of her from time to time. She wrote a book called Extreme Prejudice, because she was jailed after the Iraq War because she was starting to talk to the press. She was basically a whistleblower. And then when she was released, she brought out her Extreme Prejudice book, which is a fantastic read. And she does a show, I think, is it called Truth Frequency Radio, something like that, a radio show in the United States. And so what she was saying was that actually she believes that it was a DEA crew, a Drug Enforcement Agency crew, on that aircraft that were bringing back evidence of the CIA doing heroin dealing in the Middle East and using the money that they were making from those drug deals to fund covert operations. And they were bringing this back to present to Senate Intelligence Committee and various other investigative committees of the US government.
Yeah. And of course, it definitely wasn't the Libyans. Megrahi was released by the Scottish government, and he went back to die in Libya. But there was a Scottish police inspector was going to testify to Megrahi's appeal that the crime scene had been interfered with, to wit, that the CIA had turned up and planted this circuit board on the site, on the crime scene. And of course, there's now in the Daily Mail this week, they've pointed out that the circuit board that was planted didn't even exist at the time that the that particular make of it didn't exist at the time, and it was clearly a fabricated
A key piece of evidence has been made up, manufactured, in order to make it look as if it's a piece of evidence that points to this being a particular type of bomb. But it looks as if this Daily Mail article is saying is that it clearly was fabricated by somebody.
Well, in any case,
To fit up the Libyans.
Yeah, well, Megrahi was released on humanitarian grounds, supposedly by Alex Salmond, but in actual fact, he was released because there was about to be an appeal heard in which, as I say, a Scottish police inspector was going to testify that the crime scene had been interfered with by the CIA. And there's various theories about who really planted the bomb. One is that it's Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, based in Beirut. And don't forget, the plane had flown from Beirut. It didn't fly anywhere near Libya. But the other, as you say, Susan Lindau, the ex-CIA asset, says, well, no, in actual fact, it was the Americans who bombed the plane. And of course, people say, oh, the Americans wouldn't bomb a plane like that in Britain and kill all those people. And I just say, I've got a suspension bridge to sell you if you don't accept that's the sort of thing that goes on, because I'm afraid it does.
Well, one thing we do know is that I think it was F.W. de Klerk, certainly other people from the South African government and the AWB party, the right-wing whites-only party, were due to be on that aircraft, and they were warned not to get on it.
Indeed. And that's happened with the Korean airliner that was shot down over Sakhalin in 1979, I think it was. Nixon was going to get on that plane. He was stopped at the gate and said, don't get on that plane, sir, and he didn't. And of course, airports are very much a place where intelligence services engage in this kind of skullduggery, like the ICTS, the Mossad-linked security company in charge of all three airports on 9/11 of Schiphol in Amsterdam. Because airports are the places where they've got maximum control. I mean, you'd have thought that terrorists would attack, you know, soft targets, but no, they go for airports, because airports, in fact, are controlled by the intelligence services of various countries, and they can pull off all kinds of stunts because they control those airports.
Well, you say that, but when the Lockerbie aircraft, I believe it had come from Malta, and...
No, it didn't go to Malta. What happened was that there was a connecting flight from Malta, and the claim... ridiculously enough, is that Megrahi put the bomb on in Malta. It then got carried to Heathrow and was put on the plane. The plane had flown from Beirut. It hadn't gone anywhere near Malta. That's why the film about it, which is shown on Channel 4 some years later, was called The Maltese Double Cross. And if you think about it, how does an unattended piece of luggage get from Malta to Heathrow and then onto a plane flying from Beirut to New York? And the answer is, it shouldn't. And of course, it didn't. And that doesn't explain what happened at all.
Jim Swire, this is many, many years ago when I was working at Greater London Radio in London.
Because his daughter died, of course, on the plane.
We had interviews with Jim Swire. I spoke to him then. I've spoken to him more recently, too. He lives in Gloucestershire, and his daughter died in that. He has pointed out there are all sorts of other anomalies, too. Like, for example, there was a break-in airside, so that is to say, through the fences of Heathrow Airport, when the aircraft had landed, at the time that the aircraft had landed, and before it took off the Pan Am flight to the United States, there was a break-in. Someone had gotten in and gotten out again into the airside, that is, the aircraft aprons, the runways and that sort of thing at Heathrow Airport, just that same day.
Well, the PFLPGC theory argues that there was a regular heroin run by the CIA from Beirut to New York, and they got the bomb on by making it seem as if it was the usual suitcase of heroin. And the bomb, in fact, got on that basis. That's one of the theories that's out there. I'm inclined, having listened to Susan Lindau, to suspect that it wasn't the PFLPGC who were working for the Syrians, and therefore, you know, ultimately, you know, another baddie country. I think this is an internal job by the US security forces.
Do you think there'll be any conclusion to this? It's 30 years on, but of course, still no... I mean, one thing I will definitely do on our show page is I'll put a link up to this Daily Mail article, the most recent expose, which has been a drip, drip, drip over 30 years of more and more suspicions pointing. I mean, for example, people found very, very quickly after the crash, almost immediately after the crash, Scottish detectives said, oh, there were a whole bunch of Americans, looked like security people, wandering around the crash.
Yeah, in other words, that implies that they knew it was going to crash. And that implies that they're possibly involved, doesn't it?
What do you think there'll ever be any proper investigation into this, other than Alan Frankovich's brilliant documentary for Channel 4, The Maltese Double Cross, which I'll also put a link up on our show page.
But there's another film being made about it, and the filmmakers have cooperated. The Daily Mail's got their information about this from the new filmmakers. So, ultimately, all of this bad stuff will come back to get them. But people have got to, first of all, get it through their heads that the CIA and their allies in MI6 are not there to help them. They're criminal organisations.
Well, this did actually get mentioned at Prime Minister's Questions, but the SNP leader in the House of Commons, Ian Blackford, actually didn't say anything about all of this fascinating stuff. He just decided he wanted to bang on about Brexit. I mean, he has got two questions, and both of them were pretty much the same. He didn't ask anything whatsoever about Lockerbie. So shame on you, Ian Blackford. Let's have a listen to him now.
Mr. Speaker, this Friday marks 30 years since the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie. It was the biggest loss of life from a terrorist atrocity on UK soil. I know that the thoughts of the whole House will be with the families and friends of the 270 people who perished and all those whose lives have been affected.
Blackford! Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Speaker, can I associate myself with the remarks of the Prime Minister on the atrocity of Lockerbie, and can I wish you and everyone a Merry Christmas, a time to be spending it with friends and family. I look forward to spending it on the Isle of Skye. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, the British Chamber of Commerce, the CBI, the EEF,
well, I'm going to fade him down there, because basically just he and Theresa May list a whole bunch of organisations that support the Theresa May deal, and Ian Blackford lists a whole bunch of organisations in Scotland that don't support the Theresa May deal. Why is it, do you think, that our present-day politicians, even the SNP, who you'd think would have gotten their teeth into this, Martin, don't seem interested in Lockerbie anymore?
Well, I think that Alex Salmond released McGrathy in the end because he didn't really have any choice. It was presented as if he'd done, and of course there was lots of huffing and puffing about, well, why are you releasing him? He's dying of cancer. They released him because in actual fact the evidence shows that the Libyans weren't responsible. The evidence, and of course if they weren't responsible and McGrathy didn't do it, somebody else did. And of course that means you've got to reopen the case. And of course if the CIA were on the crime scene interfering with evidence, then they're the prime suspects. And I think the Glasgow police should basically be sent to America to arrest those people.
Well, one little chink of light at the end of the tunnel here is, it's reported in various places, but one of them is the South Wales Argus, bless them, is just today, the Lockerbie bombing probe is not static, prosecutors pledge on the 30th anniversary. This is a bit of press association copy. Scotland's Solicitor General's pledge to work in close cooperation with the United States Authority if new evidence about the involvement of others in the Lockerbie bombing comes to light. Scottish prosecutors say they've a number of strands of investigation which are producing intelligence and information supportive of the original trial court's finding the bombing was a Libyan state sponsored terrorism in which Abdel Basset al-Megrahi was a key player. Former Libyan intelligence officer Megrahi, the only person ever convicted from the bombing, died in 2012 after being released from prison early on compassionate grounds. The Crown Office said ongoing investigation is also contributing evidence to the pursuit of other individuals involved in the conspiracy to commit the atrocity. But they're not talking about this, of course. They were actually cooperating with the US officials, so maybe it's not a chink of light at the end of the tunnel. It's just more of the same.
I think it probably is, because of course once they start admitting that they carry out these kind of attacks, then the whole structure of their power begins to disintegrate, and at some point they are going to be forced out into the open, and then all of this stuff will have to be looked at again. But until they are, they're going to carry on bluffing, aren't they?
Well, what do you think of any idea what the impact politically of what the CIA were up to if they were smuggling heroin on that flight, and if they were involved in putting a bomb on that Pan Am flight? What was going on in the Middle East at the other end?
Well, the CIA and their MI6 allies are heavily involved in skullduggery in the Middle East, as anybody in the Casbah will tell you. They're not regarded as Boy Scouts helping old ladies across the road. They're seen as extremely devious and ruthless and unpleasant people, and they are. And, of course, they sell heroin to create slush funds so that they can fund, various assassinations and bombings, which then get blamed on others, and so it goes. Everybody in the Middle East, the dogs in the street know this, but of course Theresa May apparently doesn't know anything about it. Ha ha.
So let's go now to the Palestinian ambassador. His name is Dr. Hussam Zomlot, and he was here in Bristol last week, and he spoke to the Latin Window, I believe is her programme, spoke to Rosabelle from here from BCFM.
I'm from Palestine. The role of our ambassador is to represent the aspirations of his people. And as such, I have a very important task to do in the UK, because the aspirations of the people of Palestine are no different than the aspirations of any people. They are seeking a normal life, they are seeking justice, they are seeking the very rights that any other nation would be seeking. We have some way to go, but I am inspired thus far that I am not the only Palestinian ambassador in the UK. It seems there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of ambassadors like yourself and all of our friends here. So it's competitive, very competitive for me as an ambassador, but it's heartwarming to know that we have help I represent the state of Palestine. It is under occupation, but it has been created via the will of the globe, the international community. So I am the representative of Palestine, and I represent the people of Palestine, those who are inside and those who are outside. I represent the 13 million Palestinians. I head the PLO office in London. The PLO is the Palestine Liberation Organization. If you remember Yasser Arafat, that PLO represents every Palestinian. No matter where he or she come from, no matter what political background they have, they, we are all under the banner of the one legitimate representative. The Trump policies and steps, unfortunately, has meant that there are green lines now and green lights as well for the current Israeli government to do as it wish. And it has picked these signals, and it has been wreaking havoc, of course, in Jerusalem and in the West Bank. Because, you know, the West Bank and Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, according to international law, is occupied. And all the illegal colonial settlement activities there are illegal and must be dismantled according to international law. And what Trump has done is unlawful, illegal, illegitimate, isolated, and it has to be undone sooner or later. This is not a religious war, even though there are some people who want to push us towards the religious war and the Armageddon. This is a political and legal matter that can be resolved. Therefore, there is a very respected status quo in Jerusalem, including Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third most sacred place for Muslims. Jerusalem has been the place of coexistence for the three Abrahamic religions. We Palestinians would not only recognize the diversity of Jerusalem, but we will celebrate the diversity of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem belongs to one people and belongs to one God. And Jerusalem will always reject attempts at turning it into an exclusive city or changing its inclusive nature.
How do you think these new racist national state laws have affected life?
In a very bad way, and this law confirms that Benjamin Netanyahu, the current Prime Minister of Israel, and his government have chosen undemocratic laws that are a translation of the apartheid regime this government is building, as opposed to having a democratic system. The choice was always between Israel being both democratic and Jewish. It seems this government are more interested in the Jewish part of the story rather than the democratic part of the story. And I think this should be challenged by Israelis, Palestinians, and the international community, because this would be really bad news, not only for Palestinians, but also for Israelis.
Do you believe in a two-state solution, one-state solution, maybe for everyone and every Palestinian have the same rights, the equal rights?
It doesn't matter what form of a solution. What matters is that people will have their rights fulfilled and respected and maintained. The right of self-determination for people is enshrined in international law, is legitimate, and must be respected. Whether that is in a form of an independence or that is in a form of any other arrangement, doesn't matter. The right of being equal under one rule of law is also important. But I personally believe, and so the majority of the Palestinian people, is that the best way forward is to end Israel's occupation and establish a sovereign state of Palestine with East Jerusalem its capital, because we also want to have our right of self-determination. We want to embark on a journey to, you know, build our own destiny and have our own future. We don't want to mix the cards at this point in time. This conflict is about real understanding and support by the international community, because the huge, vast imbalance of power, asymmetry of power in Israel, Palestine, between Israel and Palestine, means that we need a third party that could actually save all of us. And the best way forward is the continuation of this international solidarity and the turning of this solidarity into a real pressure on all sides to make sure that the universal values are upheld, international law is implemented and respected. And as happened in South Africa, and we remember that London and the UK was the hub and the capital of activism in the anti-apartheid movement, we believe the most important and significant side at this point in time is A, our people's ability to withstand, survive, persevere, and be resilient. And I think the Palestinian people are very resilient, and this museum shows that resilience and that ability to maintain our culture and our presence and our lives, and educate our children and invest in the future. But that's all what we can do given the power, the economic military power of our oppressor. So the tilting balance would have to come from outside. Israel was established by a decision in the international community or from the international community, and we think what we need to work on right now is to make sure international side takes its responsibility. The PLO is different from the PA. The PLO is the umbrella that represents every Palestinian. It represents all Palestinians inside or and outside. The PA was established by the PLO to be a small organ that was responsible to implement the responsibilities of the PLO during the Oslo peace process, which was supposed to last for 5 years. And that PA was supposed to be evolving into a state. So effectively speaking, there is no PA anymore. There is the state of Palestine, not effectively on the ground, but according to international resolutions. We are now in the process of redefining the relationship between the state of Palestine and the Israeli occupation government.
When will there be international protection? Has the PA has any plan?
Yes, we went to the UN, to the United Nations, and we tabled a resolution for international protection, and we had an overwhelming support by member states for providing immediate protection to the Palestinian people. That was already early this year. But unfortunately, such resolutions are not implemented because major superpowers, particularly the US, always block our rights of seeking international protection. So we already have the resolution, and we already have the international will. But so far, the U.S. is shielding Israel from all of its crimes and putting Israel above the law. Any aid, regardless of who gives it, must be a function of supporting the integrity of the Palestinian land and the unity of the Palestinian people and their representation. If that aid is towards that end, supporting the unity of our people and political system and the unity of our land, we welcome it. If that aid is to help the Israeli strategic thinking, i.e. the current government, of carving Gaza out and of creating a system only for Gaza, we will reject it. This conflict is not about Gaza. Our seeking of independence is not a humanitarian issue. This is an issue about Palestine, and Gaza is a beloved, cherished part of Palestine, where I come from personally. But it's also about Jerusalem and what the Israeli government is doing in Jerusalem. It's about Nablus. Today and the last few days about Ramallah, they have been invading every house in Ramallah, every official building in Ramallah. It's about Bethlehem and our people in Bethlehem celebrating the birth of Jesus. And you know, Christmas is a Palestinian event. It started all there in Bethlehem. And therefore, it's not just about Gaza, and we want to make sure that aid goes to Palestinians, to Palestine, and then Palestine and its legitimate channels would decide. Definitely, Gaza has a severe humanitarian situation, but we will not allow for some dodgy thinking to actually create a permanent separation between Palestinian territories and Palestinian people. We do as much as we can, and it's very heartbreaking what happened in Syria for our refugees. And I don't think it has been the case anywhere else that refugees were made refugees two times and three times in one generation's life. I mean, this is unprecedented. The suffering, the sheer pain that these people had to go through. Our main policy was not to intervene, not to interfere or intervene, a neutral policy in Syria, in Lebanon. Otherwise, it would have been mayhem. We have more than 500,000 Palestinians in Syria. We have hundreds of thousands in Lebanon. So our policy of turning these people into a source of good in these countries has been very important for the stability. Otherwise, they could have been agent for many other, God forbid, terrorist groups. And also our policy was to make sure that we provide protection and the international community takes its responsibilities to provide for them. It could have been much worse. Much, much worse, but through very clear policy from our side, from our leadership, through very good commitment from our people in Syria and the Palestinian people in Lebanon, thank goodness we have been a source of stability, given how turmoil the region is.
If you had a crystal ball, when Palestine will be free?
It will be, definitely. I have no inch of a doubt, an iota of a doubt about the freedom of Palestine. I mean, this is a land that was destined to actually always be the minaret for freedom and liberty and the factory for the values that we all celebrate. It's the bridge between East and West, and therefore it has been wounded for the last 100 years. But that question is certain. The question is when, not if. And the when depends on the much work we need to do together. And I think today in Bristol I've seen that the when is closer than we even think.
That's Dr. Hussam Zomlot. He's the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. Martin, amazing, really, to see what's happening there. I suppose the cradle of civilization, that part of the world, Iraq and Israel, Syria, that whole part of the world's had such a massive influence over the millennia. What do you make of the future? He's very positive about the future, isn't he?
Well, I mean, he's trying to put a brave face on what is a rather desperate situation. And as we know, I mean, the suffering in Gaza continues and the world turns its face away.
Well, it does. And over here on Redress Information and Analysis, redressonline.com, their main story is a chap we had in here 2 weeks ago. It's Gilad Atzmon. London's Islington Council bans pro-Palestinian musician from performing in response to what they call an Israel flag waiver. Islington Council has caved into Zionist pressure and banned musician and writer Gilad Atzmon. It's a fierce campaigner for justice for the Palestinians from performing with the Blockheads. That's the remnants of Ian Dury's band at a Christmas concert in response to pressure from a single pro-Israeli campaigner. So the effects of this conflict in Israel and Palestine are still being felt, for example, in Islington.
Yes, indeed. And of course, Mossad have been involved in many false flag terror attacks, including possibly the 9/11 attack, where the five dancing Israelis were arrested after the attack, filming the first plane hitting the building. And they eventually let go after interrogation and went back to Israel. They were on Israeli television saying, yes, we were Mossad agents, but we were just documenting the attack. Documenting a supposedly surprise attack that nobody knew was going to happen, but they obviously did know was going to happen because they were there filming it. And therefore, of course, the Israelis may be implicated in that. They may be implicated in 7/7 because Netanyahu turned up, was in London on that day, and he didn't go to a meeting because the Israeli embassy said that they'd had a warning.
Well, in the United
Interesting,
States,
eh?
In the United States, it's called APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Here in the UK, there's a lot of money spent by Israel, which I suppose they just basically get for free from the Americans,
yep.
And that money gets then spent on lobbying here in Britain.
Yep.
Something called BICOM, which is Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre. I mean, there seems to be quite a lot of these lobby groups, very well funded, that they've turned, as Gilad said when he was in here a couple of weeks ago, this is a business. People can get themselves a nice salary by campaigning for the Israeli government here in Britain and trying to get concerts closed down, for example.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Israel itself, they employ students to be in troll factories who just basically sit there all day online pretending to be people they're not, trying to disrupt those who are critical of Israeli policy. That, again, all paid for by the Israeli government, but ultimately by the US taxpayer. Meanwhile, you know, veterans sleep in the streets in New York because the money's all been spent on Israel, which Israel, a very wealthy country, gets more aid per head from the US than virtually anybody else. Extraordinary. They're just subsidised to the hilt. And that, of course, means if the Americans were to get cut up with them and say, we're fed up with your attitude, they could cut off their pocket money and they'd soon come to heel, wouldn't they?
So really the US is key to getting the Israeli government to behave themselves.
It is, but of course what actually happens is the money that's given to Israel for military purposes and other purposes then gets spent back in the US as lobbying funds to try and make sure that the goose that lays golden eggs keeps laying golden eggs.
We've seen the announcement the last couple of days. Donald Trump has ordered significant Afghan drawdown, that is to say a massive load of troops coming back from Afghanistan. And on Wednesday, US will end the air war in Syria
No, he didn't say end the air war. He said we're going to take troops are coming home. That's what he said. Well, whether it'll happen or not, we'll have to see.
According to officials familiar with the situation, the announcement that the US is ending its war in Syria and withdrawing all ground troops also applies to the air war. US warplanes will stop striking Syria after troops have left. The Pentagon refused to confirm the decision officially, though, saying that they will keep conducting airstrikes so long as US troops are on the ground. After that, it would not speculate.
Well, we'll have to see what comes of this. I basically don't trust
Martin,
the US.
The big question is, this happened back in April, didn't it? And then literally within a week, we had some kind of...
Yeah, false flag chemical attack
chemical
at Douma.
Attack,
yeah.
And the decision was reversed. Do you think that the decision will stick this time?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, stuff I've been reading suggests that Trump has done some deal with Erdogan because, of course, the US Marines are embedded with the YPG and Erdogan's about to attack the YPG, and that could lead to a situation where Turkish NATO forces are fighting with US NATO forces.
What about the
They need to try and do something to prevent that.
What about the resignation of James Mattis? Because he's literally yesterday resigned. Quite clearly, it's connected with this. There are various things have been cited as possible. He says, okay, so in the article on antiwar.com, we've got Jason Ditz saying differences on myriad issues, saying he believes Trump deserves a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours.
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it, what Donald Trump actually thinks, because he changes his mind. I don't suppose he even knows what he actually thinks. How are we supposed to know?
There is no Defence Secretary right now.
Yeah, well, I think there's going to be people in the Pentagon who aren't going to be happy with Trump announcing this without discussing it with them. It's quite clear that the British have already thrown a hissy fit because they obviously weren't consulted about any of it.
There is no indication.
We shall have to see.
There's no indication of who this next Defence Secretary might be. While Mattis emphasised the need to confront Russia and China and the value of NATO in his letter, it's not clear what Trump's priority would be that differs from Mattis's own view. So he's resigned almost in a hissy fit without actually saying why.
Yeah, I suspect it's probably because Trump still wants to do things which the deep state, as it were, don't want him to do. But I think the idea that Trump can take on those people is right. I mean, he showed that over what happened over the Douma chemical weapons incident, which never happened, according to Robert Fisk of The Independent. Tell Theresa May, because she ordered an airstrike. Fortunately, the Russians responded with proportionately to that, but they would have been within their rights to hit the Akrotiri area RAF base and kill as many British personnel as possible. If you're going to shoot at us, maybe we're just going to shoot back. This is the recklessness of all
Martin,
of this.
What do you make of Putin's reaction? He's very pleased with it.
Well, Putin basically he's got to be careful
and
what he says.
His annual press conference yesterday.
He said obviously we welcome this because he's basically trying to broker a peace deal, and what the Syrian government and the Russians have said all along, you shouldn't be here at all. In actual fact, we would be within our rights to attack you because you've got no UN authorization to be in Syria. You're there illegally. So if we were to attack you and kill you, you couldn't really make any kind of defence.
And he also says that the voters' choices of Trump and Brexit are being disrespected. That is that the UK is accusing the UK and US political classes of disrespecting the public by questioning the Brexit referendum and Donald Trump's election. They don't want to recognise Mr. Trump's victory. That's disrespect of voters, he said. The same in Britain. Brexit happened, but no one wants to implement it. He also warned the world was becoming complacent about the risks of nuclear war.
Well, there's a number of different things that are being elided together there. Trump was elected, but he didn't win the majority of the votes. That's the US system, because so the Electoral College, he's the president, but he didn't win the most votes.
You take issue with Putin over that? You think someone else should have been president?
No, I think that's the American system, but it's not a democratic system. Trump didn't win the majority of the votes because the Electoral College allowed him to win.
So who should be running America?
Well, in that case, it should have been Bernie Sanders, but of course he was denied the nomination because of all the skullduggery that went in.
I mean, that's cloud cuckoo land, isn't it?
No, it's not cloud cuckoo land, but Sanders, if he'd been the Democratic nominee, would have been the president.
Donald Trump... Putin is not going to say, I think Bernie Sanders should be running America, is he?
No, what he's saying is that what he's hinting at, which is absolutely correct, is that there's a shambolic mess at the top of US politics. And it's actually built into the system, because quite frequently the president doesn't win the most votes.
And
in Russia,
and in
Putin won the most votes.
And in Britain too, he's saying.
Well, in Britain too, there was a majority that was for Brexit. But if you look at the latest opinion polls today from YouGov, there's something like a 12-point lead for Remain. Should we have another vote or not, Tony?
Maybe we should just keep voting until you get your way.
Well, maybe that's what's going to happen, Tony.
Sensible comments on Brexit in a minute, actually, from a comedian, rather more than a curmudgeon. But anyway, we're going to have a listen now to Edward Horgan. He's a retired major in the Irish Army, talking about Brexit, where he's rather concerned about the way that Shannon Airport is being used by the Americans, which, of course, is just part of the EU, just as Britain has got loads of American bases. So we sometimes forget that the Irish have got them too. And he's a campaigner that goes down to Shannon Airport regularly just to keep an eye on who's flying in and who's flying out.
Today, in fact, there was one plane, an Omni Air is the name of the company. It carries about 300 armed US troops. That particular plane, I can even give you the number. Its tail number is N207AX. For the last several weeks, that plane has been flying from the States, landing at Shannon, refueling, going on to Kuwait, then going on to some other airport in the Middle East, like Qatar, some of the air bases. And the troops are then distributed from there in smaller planes, then flies back, refuel the Shannon airport. It's probably bringing back another 300 US troops who have finished their tour of duty. And flies back to the States to some US airbase. So just today, that one, I actually photographed that plane and put it up on my own Facebook page. And that's fairly typical. In any one day, there will be several either planes on contracted US military or actual military planes themselves.
So that's Edward Horgan. I'll put up a link up to his page. He's got a campaign page for their looking at keeping an eye on American troop movements. Martin, quite a lot going in and out of Shannon Airport. In fact, troop movements around the world by the US.
Yeah, well, there's been controversy about Shannon being used by the US for rendition flights and moving troops around. Ireland is supposedly neutral, but in actual fact, the Americans have basically twisted their arms and made them participate in what they do. There's been, as you say, a lot of controversy about this over the years. I mean, people have been breaking into Shannon Airport to try and, to protest what they're doing and all the rest of it.
Okay, anyway, let's say in the first hour we'd have a listen to Steve Keane, who's an economist, who will give us a bit of a breakdown of what he thinks is really important about Brexit and also about Mario Draghi's decision last week, the chairman of the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, to stop quantitative easing, given the fact that QE is the only thing over the last 2 years that's been giving any growth in the Eurozone.
I'm Professor Steve Keane, author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist on Patreon. Well, quantitative easing has been the central bank's attempt to boost the economy after the financial crisis by trying to generate what they call a wealth effect. And the idea is that if they buy bonds off the financial sector, that means the financial sector has to buy something other than bonds with its money, because it can't sit just with a pile of cash, which it gets by selling those bonds to the central bank. So the financial institutions go off and buy shares, possibly property, boosting the share prices for those who own shares, who therefore feel wealthier and spend a bit more money consuming, and that makes the economy recover.
As a financial institution, who are these people? Do they include the private banks like HSBC, NatWest, these people?
Yes, it does. It includes all the banks and all the what they call shadow banks. So the Federal Reserve can directly buy assets off the banks because they all have accounts at the central bank, and they can indirectly buy them off companies which are shadow banks as well.
So they're buying bonds. What are these? I mean, I imagine that they are repayable over quite a long period of time and that they're for vast amounts of money.
Yeah, I mean, the usual things that the central banks do is they engage in what they call open market operations, which they abbreviate as OMO. And that is where they buy and sell bonds, normally government bonds, from financial institutions with the intention of trying to maintain the interest rate that they've set. So this is a standard thing. Banks have been doing this for decades, if not centuries. What they did with quantitative easing is they said, we promise to be on the buy side. In the argy-bargy of all this stuff, that sometimes they are mainly buying, sometimes they're mainly selling, depending whether they want to drive interest rates up or down. But for QE, they said, we are going to be on the buy side no matter what, every month indefinitely. And in America's case, I know the American figures fairly well, they promised to be on the buy side to the tune of $80 billion per month, which is $1 trillion per year, basically. And Draghi's been doing much the same for Europe. So it means in all these open market operations, netting out each month, they're going to be buying about 80 billion euros more than they sell.
The Germans said, we can't do this, we're not going to do it. And they resisted this for a very long time.
Well, for two reasons. The Germans have got a fear of inflation. Their theory was that if the central bank does this, that's going to boost the money supply and cause inflation. Of course, it hasn't happened. The reason being that when you buy bonds off financial institutions, the only things those financial institutions are legally allowed to buy with that money are other financial instruments. So if you buy bonds off them, they've got to buy either bonds or shares or property. And, of course, the easiest thing for them to do is buy shares. So a large part of the share market rally for the last decade has been courtesy of financial institutions having sold their bonds to the central bank, then used that cash to go and buy shares.
So what's going to happen, do you think? Now we've heard that from January, the Eurozone and Mario Draghi and his friends are not going to be carrying on with this QE. It's all going to come to a halt.
Well, they're calling, in place of quantitative easing, they're calling quantitative tightening. It reverses the process that the QE goes through quantitative easing. So quantitative easing, say they're going to buy, say, €1 trillion worth of bonds a year. That gives financial institutions €1 trillion worth of cash they've got to dispose of some other way. They buy $1 trillion worth of shares, driving up share prices. Now, if they're going to go into quantitative tightening, the reverse process occurs. So the banks are going to be on the sell side, $1 trillion worth a year. To balance that, the financial institutions have to raise cash. They raise cash by selling shares, so share prices will fall.
Will it be a gradual fall in share prices?
Nothing ever happens gradually on stock markets. And I think you can look at the American market and see what's actually happening over there, courtesy of their switch from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening. This year apparently will end up being the worst year for the stock market since 1929. So it's been a substantial fall in stock markets. And, 10 and 20% levels of share price falls. So once it starts happening, they'll realize that they can't actually do it without causing a stock market crash. And for that reason, I expect them to do quantitative tightening for a while, then give up and go back to quantitative easing again.
What about people like Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank? Do they know what they're doing?
They haven't got a clue. They're all trained in neoclassical economics. They all swallow this vision of the world when, in fact, all that monetary policy is supposed to do in the neoclassical world is to adjust how much investment occurs and adjust when we consume. It's not supposed to have any effect on credit because credit doesn't matter in their models. Now, credit is absolutely essential to a capitalist economy. And when you vary the interest rate and vary the amount of loans and stuff, loans you're generating, you vary demand in the economy quite directly. So they're playing with tools they have no idea of the way they work because their model of how the economy operates leaves out banks. Banks, debt, and money don't exist in their models. So if anything, get anything right, it's by intuition because their models actually lead them astray.
So if someone down the pub is saying, well, these bankers seem to be on another planet, that could be true.
It's true. I mean, they've got an intellectual planet where the economy is always tending towards equilibrium, where the financial sector is a source of frictions rather than being a lubricant, where the level of credit and debt doesn't matter at all. That's not the planet we're on.
What about the likes of the big private banks like Deutsche Bank, HSBC, versus the central banks like the Bank of England? Is there really any difference in the way they operate?
Oh, there's a huge difference because the central bank has got an unlimited capacity to create money because nobody is ever going to refuse to accept a £1 note. Or a deposit in their bank account from the Bank of England, it's very different for the private banks. Because they don't have the capacity to get into negative equity. So a central bank doesn't matter whether its assets are greater than its liabilities or not. Whereas for a private bank, if its assets aren't greater than its liabilities, it's bankrupt.
But these private banks are not going to go bankrupt, Steve. We saw that in 2008. Surely, we were told that they were bankrupt. They just got bailed out with public money. So surely they're not subject to bankruptcy in the way that you're saying. We've seen that in 2008.
Well, they don't. They can. They avoid it because again, because of the way that economists don't understand how the monetary system operates. They encouraged all this lending in the belief it was a good idea. And then when it turned out not to be one, they rescue them for making the mistakes of the lending. So, yeah, in that sense, the private banks have got the regulators by the short and curlies. They just believe that, you know, you must have a big financial sector or the world will end. It's this classic. Remember the old movie Blazing Saddles, where to get rid of a town that's opposed to a railway going through, the Mel Brooks governor sends in a black sheriff. And the black sheriff has all these guns pulled on him and realizes he's got to get out there with a bit of quick thinking. So he puts a gun to his head and says, anybody moves and then gets it. And they all stand back and don't let him shoot himself. In a sense, that's the trick that the private banks have pulled on the central bank. They make the politicians think the world needs banks to be the size that they are, when frankly they should be one quarter as big as they are.
But so would you have approved in 2008 of seeing the cash points freeze up and people losing their deposits?
No, I would 100% guarantee deposits, but I'd sack all the bank staff, terminate their bonuses and write their shares off and nationalise them until such time as they can be bought out by managers who'd be forced to be more responsible in future.
But, I mean, surely effectively they were nationalised.
Yeah, we didn't have any ownership with the nationalisation, which is nonsense. There should have been a major ownership stake as well as handing over the money. So there was the worst possible world. You buy them out and then you let them, you don't hang on to any ownership when you buy them.
What about countries like Greece, Italy? They're now actually regretting giving up their own control of their own financial policy. The lira, the drachma, that sort of thing. They're hankering to have this back. Are they right to do that? What did they give up when they gave up their own central bank and their own currency?
Oh, they gave up virtually everything. If you think about the policies that you can actually execute to try to control an economy, you have fiscal policy, monetary policy, to some extent exchange rate policy. Even with a floating exchange rate system, if the lira still existed and Germany had a lower inflation rate than Italy, then over time the lira would fall against the mark and that would slightly correct the change in inflation rates. With the euro, Germany's been running an inflation rate of 1%, despite the fact that they agreed to target 2%. Italy's been running 3%. It's not a major difference, but over a period of 15 or 20 years, they compound so much that Italian industry is uncompetitive compared to German industry. So it's a huge thing to give up. Now, the only way you could actually survive that is getting more fiscal freedom, but they threw that away as well. So rather than having the capacity to run large government deficits, which you'd need to balance a decline in your exchange rate or a decline in your terms of trade, they were forced to have tight fiscal policy as well. So it was a suicide pact right from the outset.
What about Brexit? Do you think it makes a lot of difference one way or the other as to whether Britain stays in the single market, stays in the customs union, stays in the EU effectively? That's even on the cards now.
I was one of two, myself and Richard Werner, the only economists to say Brexit is no big deal. And we're both critics of the European Union. We both think the Eurozone in particular should cease to exist. So we both voted for Brexit on that basis. It's been so badly mishandled by May, it's just beyond belief. She should have done what Yara Varoufakis said back in 2016 and just basically put a Norwegian deal on the table and say nothing, no negotiations, because she's been given the complete runaround in Brussels by bureaucrats who don't want to lose member states, they want to gain member states. So it's been a catastrophe overall. And if you move out of the customs union and you face tariffs against Europe, in terms of the pricing that's involved, you could have a major fall in the exchange rate, which would compensate for the increase in the prices of the tariff in terms of the cheapness of British goods inside the European Union. So it might have very little impact overall. The main thing is just the sheer physical practicality of getting goods through customs approval. That's the main difficulty that's faced.
Any idea which way you think it's going? Do you think there will be a Brexit? Will there be a deal? Or will it be no Brexit? Will they say, oh, well, actually, we don't think it's a good idea to leave at all?
As long as May's in control, the one thing she's adamant about is ending free movement. And that's one thing she's got in common with a lot of people who voted for Brexit. They blame the migrants. I think there's a fairly high likelihood it'll all fall in a funk and nothing will happen on March 29? I can see it just not happening because May's proposal won't get through Parliament. And the chance for anything to get through Parliament, I think, before March 29 is pretty much zero. So it'll get there, basically click over and it'll be rolled on and you'll have another year of talking about Brexit.
Any ideas when the lack of QE from the European Central Bank is really going to start to kick in and the stock markets are going to start to slide?
Well, as the QE is in first, the UK is entirely controlled by the Bank of England. The Mario Draghi stuff does nothing for Britain because Draghi doesn't produce pounds, he produces euro. So it won't be any direct impact out of quantitative tightening in Europe on the UK. It's more what does it do to the trade position of the UK? And frankly, the UK shot itself in the foot in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years by deindustrializing, in the belief that there's that it can sell services to make up for the decline in manufacturing exports. That hasn't worked. You've gone from having a trade balance to a trade deficit of about 3 to 5% of GDP. And as John Mills argues, that's partly because the pound's overvalued because the London's the world's major money laundering centre. So you'd be better off having a massive fall in the pound and get a chance to revive manufacturing. And on that front, just to give you an idea of what's happened in the last 30 or so years, about 20 or 30 years ago, manufacturing was about 20% of British GDP. It's now 10%. The same period of time ago, manufacturing was about 22% of Germany. It's still about 22% of Germany. So UK has basically bashed itself up by destroying its manufacturing sector. And I'd rather would worry about how you revive that than worry about Brexit.
On the podcast, I put the full version of that. But Martin, basically, he's saying that he doesn't think Brexit's going to make any difference at all to the economics, but QE might well do. And once the stock markets start hitting the floor around Europe, then they'll have to start doing QE again.
Well, I think it's certainly the case that there's going to be a crash, Brexit or no Brexit. I mean, that's really a storm in a teacup compared to the fundamental problems of the financial services sector globally.
What will trigger that crash?
Well, it could be, by accident, Brexit might be the trigger, but it could easily be the collapse of the Italian banking system, I would suggest, is the most likely trigger at the minute. But it could easily happen from something completely different that nobody even thought of yet, because the whole thing's a house of cards. Whether you've got a house of cards, you only have to take one card out and the whole thing falls down, and any card will do.
Well, he seems to think that that's what will happen anyway. So there'll be a collapse in share prices, and then they'll have to start QE all over again in the Eurozone in the new year, or in the spring, as all the effects of their stopping QE starts to kick in. So you'll find the rest of that on our podcast, which you'll find on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I'll leave you this week with a guy called Sammy Wilson. He's what you might call a Brexit comedian.
The EU, as a punishment to the people of the United Kingdom, are demanding that the price of leaving will be to break up the United Kingdom. We won't let them. I've only got 10 minutes. These are not my notes. But I brought it along tonight because I wanted to show you what we're going to pay £39 billion for. £700,000 pounds a page, nearly. And every page carries an obligation to bow the knee to the EU and to destroy the vote of the people of the United Kingdom. If we abided by this agreement, folks, what people voted for would not be delivered. This requires us to stay in the customs union. It requires us to tie ourselves to EU law. It only allows us to be free if the EU says we can be free. And even if we do decide that we want to break away, Northern Ireland will be left as an annex of the EU. And we'll not have. It goes further. And I'm not joking you. There's actually parts of this, if you look at Article 29 of the agreement, we have to keep on putting out EU propaganda. And when we leave, according to Article 127, we can't even say bad things about them. And the Prime Minister says it's a good deal. Del Boy and Arthur Dilly would be ashamed to call it that. And how do we get into this mess? How do we get tied up with this? Well, and you heard from Kate. This is all down to a problem that exists along the Irish border. It was thought at one stage that the 10 Northern Ireland MPs who take their seats in the House of Commons would be the people who could either make or break this deal. We're an irrelevancy now. Because there are that many people against this deal, we could sit at home and watch it on the TV. But Northern Ireland is an irrelevancy in this. Northern Ireland is now being used by the EU in an attempt to keep the UK in the EU. This was brought about when the, and I think the EU, the negotiators sat down, how can we create a problem which creates a situation where we can say you cannot leave because there are such big problems? And the Irish government and the EU sat down and they contrived the biggest con trick that you'd ever think of. Back in Northern Ireland, and in Ireland as a whole, we have, if you tell a tall story, it's called You Won't Kiss a Blarney Stone. In this case, they made love to the Blarney Stone, I think, when they came up with this one. Because, of course, the EU and the Irish government have created a problem which does not exist. And let's just look at it. First of all, they say that you could not have us leaving the EU without a hard border. Now, I don't know what a hard border means yet, and nobody's ever explained it. And certainly, if we, by hard border you mean that you have to have the border totally closed, we couldn't do that with 50,000 troops, with watchtowers, with patrols, with roads being blown up. We couldn't do it. And yet we're told it'll be a hard border. In fact, Leo Varadkar has suggested at one stage we might even have to have a Berlin Wall around the border. I don't know who's going to build it. Donald Trump, if he's, when he's finished at Mexico, might want to come over and do it for us too. So what would it mean? What would you have to do for a hard border? I'll tell you one thing, if 50,000 troops couldn't do it, a lot of barber poles across the main roads between Northern Ireland and the Republic won't do it either. But it's not even necessary, folks. Every day, trade goes across the Irish border and taxes are collected. Every day into the Irish Republic comes trade from third countries, from China, from Africa, from South America, where there are no similar rules to what there are in the EU. Is every container opened? No, of course it's not. The goods come in, they go to the shops, trading standards officers check them. They don't need to be checked at the border. They're checked at the point of sale or the point of distribution. And when it comes to animal checks, we already do animal checks. We have similar veterinary standards. It can all be, it's all doable. And yet, we are told that isn't necessary. It's a con trick, of course. It's a con trick device to keep us in the EU. Now, the Prime Minister would say, oh no, it's only temporary. In fact, the EU don't even really want it. They spent a year and a half fighting for it. They sent her away today with her tail between her legs because they wouldn't even make an amendment to it. And we're told they don't want it. Of course the EU want it because it's a way of keeping us in. And every action that they've taken shows that. Only this week we've had the European Court of Justice ruling that we can extend Article 50 time if we want, unilaterally. Here's an organisation that usually works about the same pace as evolution, and it made a decision within 4 or 5 days. There's nothing political about that. They don't want to keep us in. Of course they do. And as the deadline approaches, I can tell you that this deal, or any of the amendments which the Prime Minister is seeking to it, we don't want assurances. The assurances will be given by people who will not even be there after May, because there's European elections. They would have to be exercised by a government that might not even be in power when we have to do these things. So what are the assurances worth? And I believe that come the 29th of March, folks, we must leave. Yeah. And unlike those who are spreading hysteria at the moment, I don't believe that leaving on those terms, leaving without an agreement with the EU, will be disaster. We've been told that there'll be no food in the shops, no medicines in the hospitals, no Mars bars. I could do without that anyway for a wee while. We'll be starving. I don't understand this. For 6 years during the war, U-boats, the Luftwaffe, the Wehrmacht couldn't starve us out. And yet we are told that a bunch of bureaucrats from Brussels, armed with the European Code of Customs, are going to stop all of our trade, are going to starve us out. In the words of the old Dad's Army theme, who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Hammond, if you think we'll fall for that? I just want to finish off on a serious note, though, because what's at stake here, folks, is that people voted. They came out in their millions and voted in June of 2016. They expect politicians to deliver on that. If you want to undermine democracy, then you go for the kind of deal which keeps us half in the EU and half out of the EU, and only ability to get freed when the EU decide to let us go. That's not democracy. And I'll tell you, from the point of view of Northern Ireland, we are not going to accept, in the words of the Attorney General, a situation where we have to regard the rest of the United Kingdom as a third country, where we find ourselves cut off from our main market, where we find that we can't take part in trade deals, where we find that forever we will have our laws made in Brussels without any input or any ability to change them, regardless of how damaging they are. That's not democracy. That's dictatorship. We'll not have it.
DUP MP Sammy Wilson does quite a good turn, amazing. So long as, of course, a lot of the Remainers probably won't like it. Anyway, we'll leave you with that. Here's wishing you a relaxing, enjoyable Christmas break. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. There might be some changes around here. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.